Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, and Steve Ember. But first, this report. American Carter Ocelet is back in his childhood bedroom. He was sent home from Michigan State University because of the coronavirus crisis. But he told the Associated Press that he is still paying to use an empty apartment near his college. Ocelet buys food for an aunt recovering from COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. His mother is now seeking government unemployment payments. Ocelet's summer study program at a university in Brazil has been canceled. And he is not sure he will graduate in December as planned. For many of the nearly 2 million people in the United States expected to earn bachelor's degrees in 2020, the crisis has taken away many things. These include their housing, friends, and dreams of a graduation ceremony. Some college students in their final or senior year face real-world responsibilities as they try to support themselves or struggling family members. For others, adulthood is being delayed. Their plans for after college, including work and travel, have been canceled. Now they must move back home. Nearly all of these students fear their first steps into adulthood will be affected by a worldwide recession. Barry Schreier is a University of Iowa psychologist and communications chairman of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors. He urges students to hold on to their goals, although they may have to delay their plans. He said they should also expect to go through levels of sadness, which include denial, anger, and depression. Schreier noted that accepting adult responsibilities, often called adulting, is difficult on good days. And these are certainly not good days, he added. Axel Lopez is in his senior year at the University of California, Los Angeles, known as UCLA. He takes pictures of sporting events for the school's newspaper, The Daily Bruin. He had hoped to take a last walk through the newsroom before moving to Utah to take a job in the summer. Instead, he is now quarantined in his apartment near UCLA and taking his final classes online. The expected summer job offer never came. It's a very uncertain time, considering just a couple of months ago, it seemed there was a surplus of jobs available, he said. Lopez is a first-generation college student. He joined his mother growing up as she cleaned houses in Los Angeles. He had dreams of hugging his mom at graduation and telling her, yeah, it was all worth it. UCLA announced its June graduation ceremony would be held online, then reconsidered after criticism. The university has promised to hold an in-person celebration later. Even though we're going to have it in the next year, I feel it won't be the same, Lopez said. Victoria Arevalo is back in her family's small two-bedroom apartment in West Los Angeles. She had hoped to stay in her apartment at nearby Loyola Marymount University, where she is studying communications. But she knew her family needed the money that would be returned to her if she came back home. That is because her stepfather's job at a storage business was suspended. Very quickly, Arevalo lost her emotional safe space, her paid TV news position, and her final months with her college friends. At first, she voiced her anger on social media. But after a few weeks back home, she accepted the situation and the road ahead. "I know it's going to be a lot harder than it would have been. I'm just trying mentally to prepare myself," said Arevalo. She is a 22-year-old immigrant who came to the United States from El Salvador as a child. For health sciences student Anali Reyes Vazquez, the crisis has caused problems. Her parents are out of work. But there also is a possibility of something good. The 21-year-old senior at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey, planned to find a job and continue her education in June. Those plans are on hold. However, one of her final classes is on medical translating. This could help her find a position serving Spanish-speaking patients. "There are people in need," she noted. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. The English language has many expressions that describe a fast-moving event. Some expressions relate to body movements. We say something happens in the blink of an eye or in a heartbeat. Other expressions are related to the world of nature. Today, we will talk about a speed-related expression involving an animal. Now, because we are talking about speed and animals, you might think it is a big cat, such as a lion or cheetah, or maybe even a small but speedy animal, such as a hare. But it is none of them. You guessed it. The expression today involves sheep. Baby lambs, to be exact. But why? Lambs are cute, but they are not really known for their lightning speed. Well, our expression is about a specific part of the animal, its tail. I suspect lambs can shake their tails very fast, because when something happens quickly, we say it happens in two shakes of a lamb's tail. Here is an example. "I'm going to the store. I'll be back in two shakes of a lamb's tail." This expression is a cuter and more descriptive way of saying quickly. Maybe instead of sending a text message with the letters BRB, be right back, we could use the image of a lamb shaking its tail. That would be fun. Being cute like a lamb may be fun, but it has its drawbacks. Cute things are often not taken seriously. And this cute factor is the main reason Americans rarely use two shakes of a lamb's tail in a serious situation. For example, if I see a person get hit by a car, I would not say, "Hold on, help will be here in two shakes of a lamb's tail." That would not make the injured person lying in the middle of the street feel reassured. In an emergency like that, I would say something like, "Help is on the way." Generally speaking, an emergency is not a good time to use cute animal expressions. Some language experts say Two Shakes of a Lamb's Tale was first used in written English in the 1800s. They think that it was used in spoken English much earlier than that. You should know that we often shorten this expression to simply two shakes, as in, I'll be there in two shakes. You should not use that one for emergencies either. And that is words and their stories for this week. But we will be back in Two Shakes of a Lamb's Tale. Well, actually, we'll be back next week. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Taher al-Matar's home in northwest Syria is in ruins, but he has returned there to live in it. He decided it was safer to live in the wreckage of his house than to stay in a camp for displaced people. Such camps are crowded, and he fears getting infected with the coronavirus. Matar worries that the ceasefire in the Idlib area may not last. Yet he is clearing rubble from what remains of his house. He looks for any unexploded shells that could have fallen near it during the government's latest offensive. It's better than living in the camps. We were there. We lived the humiliation, he told the Reuters news agency. Matar's home is in Nerab, a town close to territory held by rebels from Russian-backed Syrian government forces. A missile struck the house 3 months ago. They tell us to stay home because of Corona, but in the camps, the tents are right next to each other and people can't keep their distance, Matar said. He wants to spend Islam's holy month of Ramadan with his 6 children at home. Thousands of Syrians have started moving back to the Idlib region since Russia and Turkey negotiated a truce. The ceasefire took effect in March. It stopped an offensive in the last remaining rebel-held area in Syria. The fighting has displaced nearly 1 million people. Many had already fled other battles earlier in the 9-year war. Officials are worried that the new coronavirus could infect displaced persons in the overcrowded camps. So far, there have been no confirmed cases. A local aid agency reported that nearly 120,000 people had returned to towns in Idlib and the Aleppo countryside since the ceasefire. What will happen next, only God knows. At the end of the day, a person has nothing but his home, said Saher al-Ali. He is a driver who also went back to Nerab to try fixing his house. Airstrikes destroyed the windows and doors even before his family escaped. At first, Ali searched for other houses, but they were all too costly or full. They were in the camps before they returned. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin the story of Bill Clinton, America's 42nd president. He led the United States for 8 years, from January of 1993 to January of 2001. Our story begins in 1991, In February of that year, American-led forces won Operation Desert Storm to end Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein considered Kuwait a province of Iraq. He had invaded the oil-rich country in August 1990. Coalition airstrikes began 4 months later in January against Iraqi targets. The ground war took place in February and lasted just 4 days. The American-led victory in the Gulf War added to the popularity of President George H.W. Bush. 1991 was also the last year for the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The collapse of the Soviet Union brought an end to more than 40 years of Cold War tensions and fears of nuclear war. In the United States, attention was turning to the 1992 presidential election. Many political observers believed President Bush would easily win a second term. But the economy was not doing much to help his chances. The United States went through a serious recession that lasted 8 months, from July 1990 to March 1991. Unemployment rose to the highest level in years. At the same time, the federal government was deeply in debt after years of borrowing. Bush was a Republican. Democrats saw his falling popularity as a good opportunity to retake the White House. They placed their hopes on William Jefferson Clinton. At the time, he was the young governor of the southern state of Arkansas. He was gaining national attention by talking about issues like education. Bill Clinton was born on August 19, 1946, in the small town of Hope, Arkansas. His name at birth was William Jefferson Blythe. His father, also named William Jefferson Blythe, was a traveling salesman. He died in a car accident 3 months before his son was born. At the age of two, the boy was sent to live with his grandparents, while his mother, Virginia Blythe, studied to become a nurse. She married a man named Roger Clinton when her son was four. The family moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas. When he was 15, William Jefferson Blythe legally changed his name to William Jefferson Clinton. His stepfather drank too much and was sometimes abusive to him, his mother, and his stepbrother, Roger Jr. But Bill Clinton did well in school. He also developed a strong early interest in politics and ran for student offices in high school. In 1963, while still in high school, Bill Clinton went to Washington as a delegate to a Boys Nation program for young leaders. There, he got to meet President John F. Kennedy. Years later, Richard Stratton, who was president of Boys Nation in 1963, remembered that meeting.
It was a beautiful, bright summer day. It was July 24, 1963. And we were all assembled in the Rose Garden at the White House as a group, waiting for the president to come out. We all sat there, riveted in attention.
We want to welcome you to the White House, particularly because this belongs to all of you and because it's so intimately connected with the best in American history.
I was about the third or fourth person in. And he started here, and I sort of muscled my way up and made sure I got to shake hands with the president. He was quite generous. He went down the line and shook hands with a pretty good number of us who were there that day. It had a very profound impact on me. I think that, you know, it's something that I carried with me always. And And I was very fortunate that someone took a picture of it and gave it to me, so I was always able to remember it.
Right after that frame, the famous frame of him shaking hands with JFK, there's another picture from the same film showing President Kennedy shaking hands with Jeff Keyes, another one of our boys, him from Florida, and Bill Clinton looking down at his hand with this wonderful look like I'll never wash it again.
Bill Clinton went on to study at Georgetown University in Washington. He graduated in 1968 and won a Rhodes Scholarship to attend Oxford University in England. He spent 2 years there before entering Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut. There, he met another law student, Hillary Rodham. She was from just outside Chicago, and she shared his deep interest in politics and public service. They both graduated in 1973. Bill Clinton returned to Arkansas. Hillary Rodham went on to become a lawyer involved in the congressional investigation of the Watergate scandal. That case led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon in 1974. That same year, Bill Clinton, a Democrat, ran for Congress in Arkansas. He lost the close race to a popular Republican. A year later, he and Hillary Rodham married. And a year after that, in 1976, Arkansas voters elected him Attorney General, the state's top law enforcement officer. In 1978, Bill Clinton ran for governor and easily won. He became, at the age of 32, the state's youngest governor ever. While Bill Clinton was governor, the federal government operated a detention center in Arkansas for Cuban refugees. The refugees rioted. That rioting hurt Bill Clinton politically when he ran for re-election. His opponent argued that he should have done more to get the government to hold the Cubans someplace else. Also, Clinton had supported unpopular new taxes. In 1980, Bill Clinton was defeated in his campaign for a second term as governor of Arkansas. But he regained the office in the next election 2 years later. That was before the term of office was increased from 2 years to 4 years. Clinton went on to serve as governor of Arkansas until 1992. While he was governor, education in the state improved. More students finished high school, and more went on to college. The state increased requirements for teachers and also increased their pay. Governor Clinton also expanded early learning programs for children from poor families. While governor, Bill Clinton also became active in Democratic Party leadership at the national level.
Make no mistake, this election is about change. Change in our party, change in our leadership, change in our nation. And that is why today I proudly announce my candidacy for President of the United States of America.
In 1991, Bill Clinton announced that he would run for the Democratic nomination for president. His main opponents were Paul Tsongas and Jerry Brown. Tsongas was a former senator from Massachusetts. Brown had been governor of California. Paul Tsongas later withdrew, and Bill Clinton easily defeated Jerry Brown for the nomination. Democrats held their national nominating convention in New York City in July 1992.
And so, in the name of all those who do the work, pay the taxes,
raise the kids, and play by the rules. In the name of the hardworking Americans who make up our forgotten middle class, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Bill Clinton chose Senator Al Gore of Tennessee as his running mate for vice president. The Republicans nominated President Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle for a second term. Another candidate in the 1992 presidential election was a Texas businessman named Ross Perot. He competed as an independent, a so-called third-party candidate. His choice for vice president was James Stockdale, a former high-level Navy officer and pilot. He had been shot down and held as a prisoner of North Vietnam for 7 years. During the campaign, Ross Perot argued that neither of the major candidates was taking the national debt seriously enough. He also warned of the loss of American jobs.
To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Bill Clinton criticized President Bush for not doing more about the economy and unemployment. Bush pointed out that the Democrats controlled Congress, and he said the Democrats had defeated most of his proposals. The president also talked about his foreign policy successes, and most famously, he promised not to raise taxes.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say, read my lips. No new taxes.
But raise taxes he did, and many Americans remembered that on Election Day. Bill Clinton and Al Gore won the 1992 election. They received about 45 million votes, or 6 million more than President Bush and Vice President Quayle. Ross Perot and James Stockdale received close to 20 million, or 19% of the popular vote. Bill Clinton became America's 42nd president on January 20th, 1993. At the age of 46, he was the third youngest person ever elected president. At his inauguration, the new president said there was no longer a division between foreign and domestic issues.
The world economy, the world environment, the world AIDS crisis, the world arms race, they affect us all. Today, as an old order passes, the new world is more free but less stable. Communism's collapse has called forth old animosities and new dangers. Clearly, America must continue to lead the world we did so much to make.
But even as he took office, critics were questioning Clinton's character. There had been accusations during the campaign about relationships with other women in Arkansas. And there were questions about an investment that he and Hillary Clinton had made in a land development project back in 1978.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.